ओमिज्ञानचिमरमस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकय चक्षुरुन्मुदतं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कृता मायं ददाति स्वाप्तदन्तिकम् पञ्चकौपाथुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभयेभ्य च पतितानं पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्रियाद्वैत गदाधर शिवासदि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे. Greetings from the Sun Falls, Stuyvesant Falls, where I live when I'm not traveling. The reception here on the phone is not always good. The call may get dropped. At least, I don't know, maybe the weather is something. I'm having problems. I also have my computer on in case something happens, someone could send me a message. The tenor of this class lately is just for me to be sharing things that I'm speaking on. So I'm maybe share one or two things, starting with a little summary of the lecture I gave at Rutgers University. Professor Bryant is a good friend of mine, and he has a beautiful edition of the Yoga Sutras that were put out. And he asked me to give his class. It is a lecture hall. I mean, I think about 250 people or something in the class on Hindu philosophy. And they were studying Shankar. Sometimes we say Shankar Acharya, who preached the doctrine of Mayavad. Vad means school. The school that any differentiation or any distinction that we see is illusion. Although this is an extremely minority view in Indian thought, because it was there are six schools of Indian thought. There's Nyayaka, Nyaya, Mamamsa, Visheshika, Shankhya, Vedanta, and Yoga. And basically what those schools are is that the Vedas were one. Veda means knowledge. The concept is that there's a world and there's knowledge of the world manifest with the world, and they manifest from the same thing, and that's Om, from sound. God said in the Bible, let there be light. So there's some truth from the sound, which is the most subtle of the material elements, because sound is the only element which can be perceived within ether. All other material elements, earth, You can see, you can smell, you can touch, you can hear. Fire, you can see, you can touch, you can't taste. Water, you can taste, you can see, you can feel, you can hear. So they, but sound is the most subtle. So the manifestation is subtle to grow. So in the creation, from sound comes to creation, and within that sound comes knowledge. Veda means knowledge. And what is that knowledge? That knowledge is the utility of everything, which means that the creation has a purpose. And the purpose of the creation, the Danta Sutra mentions two things for prakriti, why the prakriti or matter. There's two things: to give people a facility to enjoy and to give one the field by which they can become liberated from that concept. So ultimately, it's all related to liberation. Liberation is the theme. It's the particular concept or idea that unifies every other concept or idea within the universe, even though apparently unrelated. Either something is meant to help us enjoy, to become frustrated with enjoyment. Things are meant to enjoy, to give us a sense of mental satisfaction so we can be peaceful in mind. Or things are meant to assist us in our spiritual focus and liberation, to become detached from this world. So it was one, the concept that was one. And the concept is that to help people understand, sometimes subjects are broken into parts. But to someone who has advanced mental faculties, the more advanced one's mental faculties are, the less required to break it into pieces. It's just like a child. If you give a child a piece of flat, if you give an adult a piece of flat bread, he can eat the thing whole. But if it's a child, the mother will have to break it into little pieces to make it digestible. So basically, there's a concept that knowledge is in time broken up into pieces to help people be it digested. So, Pantanjali saw the profound psychological knowledge in the Vedas, how the mind works. And through the control of that mind, how one can purify the lens of the mind to make a clear distinction between the soul and the body and become liberated from it. So he extracted that and put it in one school. And Nyayaka deals with logic. Vaisheshika deals with science. So in various ways, different. And Vedanta deals with philosophical knowledge. So in one of the schools of Vedanta, really propounded by Shankaracharya, and in our tradition, this historical need for Shankaracharya, Prabhupada said his philosophy was a timely necessity, not an absolute fact. But what was the timely necessity? The timely necessity is somehow or other, because the Vedas bring everyone into a religious sphere, regulate their desires and activities to gradually purify them. But it even takes people who have a desire to eat meat and brings them into the realm of a sacrifice whereby the animal becomes rejuvenated by the power of mantra. which is different from wholesale slaughterhouses. So, and those people come under, you know, they come into a religious context. They get association with priests who have a higher values and higher knowledge of themselves. But on the basis that the allowance in the Vedas was being abused for the wholesale slaughter of animals, and as the basis, the foundation of liberation, is the foundation by which everything else can build is nonviolence. Because if you can't control your mind in relationship to how you deal with others, how can you control the mind in relationship to your habits? How can you control your mind in terms of extracting yourself from the mind and the senses? What to speak of controlling your mind to the fact that you don't think of anything else but the object of your meditation? So when there is, in the name of religion, nonviolence, then everything else becomes ineffective. So it's understood, at least the historical, from the perspective of the Vaishnavas, that Shankaracharya, because Buddhism is basically atheistic. So Shankaracharya, to appeal to those people, he preached some kind of a similar philosophy. But that's Advaita Vedanta, absolute non-dualism. Everything is absolute non-dualism. But non-dualism to the extent of denying the energies of that absolute reality. That particular philosophy was carried by Vivekananda in 1996 to the World Parliament of Religions. And as Indian philosophy in general and the culture behind it is very powerful, it became prominent. And people came under the misconception that that represents Indian thought. So that's the history behind Shankaracharya. So I think it's very, very helpful, especially in the university, for students to hear another perspective, and in one sense, a much more popular perspective of Indian philosophy, which is the eternal individuality of the souls. So Mahamuni, he comes in on Sunday. He's a professor at Bridgewater and specializes in Nyaya. And Nyaya is the theistic, the arguments for theism, actually. So, we discussed with him. And basically, what Shankaracharya was trying to do is he had a problem because the Upanishads, which are the is so much ritualistic activity in the Vedas, the Upanishads are the extracting the analytical or philosophical part of the Vedas. The problem he had was to explain or reconcile Brahman, which is defined as that which unites, pervades, includes, supports reality, with the God of the Upanishads, with the more personal aspect of the Upanishads. And how do you reconcile that? Because according to his view, that if something is distinct or manifest from God, he is less fragmented, changed, and therefore not eternal. That's their basic argument, which I'm going to show that why I believe it doesn't really hold up. And he gives, you know, there are different statements. Agama means verbal testimony. And there are statements within the Upanishads that seem to promote that basic view or idea of reality as undifferentiated oneness. And his resolution is therefore any distinction described in the Upanishads, any distinction, individuality that we see in the world, must be illusion. So that's how he resolves that there's descriptions of God in terms of undifferentiated oneness. There's also a personal aspect of God, no doubt described. His thing, his understanding, the distinction is it must be illusion. And God is the best understanding of that absolute reality when one is in delusion or ignorance. So somehow he makes that distinction. So the Nayakas, the theistic logicians, they have very, very strong arguments, and these are also arguments from Vaishnavacharyas. A very simple argument. I mean, first of all, it's not what we see and perceive in the world. And we have no frame of reference to understand something like that. We can't even understand what would be the necessity for teaching if the teacher would be an illusion by the very fact that he's trying to influence someone else, which means he's making a distinction. So the resolution is how do you account for distinction? And Shankar would say, it's only cosmic illusion. It must be illusion. But then if someone makes the argument it's illusion, who is being deluded? Illusion means that there must be a support of illusion. There must be something in illusion. So Shankaracharya says, well, it's the jivas, but according to his philosophy, the jivas are also a product of illusion. Because that's also a distinction. So they also don't exist. So what exists that's in illusion? And then his argument would have to come to the fact that Brahman is an illusion. Well, that's also a distinction. Then there's Brahman and illusion. Anytime you can't even say Brahman because Brahman is a name. A name indicates a quality or a distinction. So how can you say the absolute reality is covered by illusion? They say that. When the absolute reality is covered by illusion, this is what it is. Or we are God, but we're covered by illusion. If we're God, how can we be covered by illusion? Who am I right now? Well, you're God, but you're covered by illusion. Because everything is God. How can illusion be greater than Brahman? If Brahman is the unlimited, Brahman means great. And how can Brahman be? So these are very solid arguments. And then you have how does this view of absolute undifferentiated distinction account for the scriptures which speak in duality? Krishna is talking to Arjuna. So what is the answer And what if Krishna is an illusion? If Krishna is Brahman in the mode of ignorance, whatever that makes, then what's the value of his teaching? Who is he teaching to? So these are very powerful arguments. Inherently, people can't believe this. Just like Hanuman. Hanuman was a great devotee of Ram. And what the Mayavadi philosophy is that individuality is an illusion. And in liberation, we merge. Meaning, we no longer exist. So Hanuman, who's a great devotee of Ram, what did Hanuman say? He said, if liberation means that I become one with Ram, I don't want to be liberated because it denies the principle of love. It denies the principle of love. Love requires subject and object. Everyone has that experience. So, it's not a palatable, reasonable. What's reasonable? Reasonable is how we perceive things in this world under certain laws. And what do we perceive in this world? We perceive that everyone's seeking pleasure, and pleasure is devotion or love. So why shouldn't that exist in reality? And if it exists in reality, then within that one harmonious, absolute reality, there must be some type of differentiation within it for the purpose of the exchange of love. That's a reasonable conception of the absolute reality. What Shankaracharya is denying is that there's any Shakti or energy. There's no distinction. There's not for service. And in terms of the Upanishads, there are other Upanishadic verses that say differently. So the reconciliation is that there is oneness, but oneness doesn't deny that there is a harmony. For example, I can point to my hand, it's my hand. I can point to my nose. I have the hand, that's my body. I point to my nose, that's the body. It's one. It's all one. Of course it's one. But why limit the distinction within it? It's all God. But there are different functions. And the part is not the whole. The hand is not the whole body. The hand is part of the body. Why? For the purpose of service. And therefore, there's a description of the absolute reality as rasa vai saha. It's a juice, it's a flavor, it's a mellow of love. And that mellow of love requires energy or shakti that's exchanged between, and that's what Vyasadeva, he wrote the Bhagavatam, which is the main theistic text of bhakti. What did he say? Maya chitat apastrayam. He saw apashyat purusham purnam. Maya chitat apastrayam. He saw the apashyat purnam. He saw that complete absolute whole. And he saw maya energies under the control, and that exchange of energy, that absolute exchange of energy, That's Krishna. That's Krishna's devotees. That's an exchange of love. That's what the absolute reality is. The exchange of God and his energies is an exchange of love. Isn't that reasonable? Anyway, I had a lot of fun. This is the way I was up there on the stage. You know, they had a mic attached to me. You know, kind of prancing around. You know, young teenagers, you know, early 20s, keeping their attention. But it's a great group. Radhanath Swami will be speaking there on the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhakti section, next Thursday. When they had the Mayapuris and Radhanath Swami, they had 500 students came to the kirtan in the evening and danced like anything. It's a good place. So, and then the professor asked on the following day, he told me, you know, how many students, you know, liked the lecture. He said, everyone raised their hands. And then he said, how many students would not invite him back? He said, only one out of 250 raised their hand. So Isha Upanishad says, Om Purnama Dham Purnami Dham Purnat Purnat Vidachate. The supreme absolute reality is perfect and complete. And even though so many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. Why should the absolute reality be limited in any way? If you say the absolute reality has no form, then you're limiting the absolute reality. The absolute reality is Adwayam Jnana, it's consciousness, which is inclusive of everything, which doesn't have the defect of impersonality. It doesn't have the defect of impersonality. You're limiting the absolute reality if you deny its powers, and its powers of love, and its powers of beauty, and its powers of exchange. And the Vaishnava school fully embraces that within that Advayam Jnana, that non-dual consciousness, beauty is manifest at the same time. It's not spread out, it's spread out everywhere, but it can be before you. It doesn't have that limit of personality. Sometimes people want to say that absolute reality is different, is opposite from what we see here. But what is opposite? What is opposite of poor? It's not no money, it's rich. So there's an understanding of the absolute reality, neti neti. They say it's not this, it's not this. So it's not of this world. That doesn't say what it is. There's a story that my Guru Maharaj would tell about this. He said there was a person on an island, and all his life, he never had sweets, never saw what sweets are. He had bitter, sour, pungent, hot, and salty. So somehow he left the island and he found sweets and he was so incredibly happy, he wanted to explain it to the people on the island, they said, "What is it?" He said, "It's not salty, it's not pungent, it's not sour, it's not hot, not bitter." Well, what is it? It's not. He can only say what it wasn't. He couldn't say what it is. So there is a vision of the absolute truth, of saying what it's not, and it's not of this world. But because it said it's not of this world, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have any quality. It just doesn't have quality of this world. So, really, this type of perspective, what it's trying to do, Shankara, is put that absolute reality under the laws we see here. So what do we see here? We see that if something is coming from something, it makes it less. If something is coming from something, then the original thing is not eternal because it's been changed. But the absolute reality means that although so many units are, it remains the same. It has absolute potency. Of course, the sun burns out, but it's like that. Heat and light is coming from the sun. Heat and light is coming from the sun, but it kind of remains there, powerful. And therefore, the Upanishad says that it is reasonable to see the absolute reality in terms of inconceivable potency. That he's everywhere without defect. He's everywhere without impersonality. He's everywhere without being burdened. He's everywhere without being responsible. Tadejati, tadejati, tadre, tadvantike, tarantarasya, sarvasya, tadusavasya, but the Supreme Absolute Reality is he walks, he doesn't walk. He's near, he's far, he's inside and outside. By definition, the Absolute Reality has inconceivable potency, which we see even in his created manifestation. A whole forest can start from one seed. That means that that seed contains the whole forest. That's inconceivable potency. So, oops, my computer froze up, which means what happens to the rest of my notes. Okay, take me a second here. Anybody have any questions so far? Okay. Anyway,
I have a question.
Go ahead.
It's Bianca. The question is about the things being there to enjoy, to experience that, but then again, isn't Krishna supposed to be the supreme enjoyer that they are, that we are supposed to be providing that instead of experiencing it so much so? Do you see what I'm saying?
Just say that. Say that one more time. Go ahead.
It's being the enjoyer is being the seen.
Right.
Instead of the seer. I was just saying that having and being able to have distinction and enjoy that, and you know, but some people seem to really over relish in that, and they get so caught up in it that it's all about the senses enjoying these distinctions.
Right.
So to balance that with service and providing the or being that which Krishna enjoys, then.
Yeah, we have to. Yeah, go ahead. Anything else?
No, that was it. I mean, I just felt like that, you know, I see more that people are constantly looking to enjoy. And that, in a way, becomes a really strong distraction that I don't really see that they can create a distinction.
Well, there's a way to enjoy without polluting your consciousness, and that's love. For example, a mother can cook for their children, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she makes it very nice for their pleasure. After the children eat, the mother may taste it, right? So she'll have this sensual experience.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience is that they enjoy. So that's the mood of, you know, in terms of, you know, we need enjoyment because our body functions in that way. So the Bhagavatam says, they ask the question, how much enjoyment do we need?
Mm-hmm.
It says, kamesya nendriya pritir labo jidatit. You take as much as you need. In other words, we eat to live, we don't live to eat. We may enjoy to live, we don't live to enjoy. So within the conditioned state, there is a certain requirement of enjoyment, but only as much as we need to keep the body and soul together for the higher endeavor of self-realization. And then at the highest, at the highest stage, you know, one's internal enjoyment, the nature of the soul, and the bliss of that in relationship to God becomes so happy that one is detached from any type of enjoyment in this world. Vishyavinivartante nirahasya dehana viso rajam viso. That when you get the higher taste, param drishta, the highest supreme taste, then anything else becomes pale in comparison. So I'm not sure if I answered your question. You want to
you
say
did.
Anything?
You did. Exactly. I think that was exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking of the second part, the higher realms of enjoyment that aren't necessarily connected to.
They're not connected at all.
Right.
When you have that, it also says in the Yoga Sutras that the wise man sees suffering and happiness in this world. Because what he sees, I mean, this is from the philosophy of yoga, what he sees in this world is anything that attaches one to the body, well, ultimately it will bring him suffering. But it doesn't deny, because it's a very, very practical philosophy, and we're not vairagis. Vairagis means without attachment, like militant about it. We're not militant about it. Our renunciation is that hari sambandha vastuni, that we give up that which hari sambandha vastuni, that substance which we doesn't have a relationship to Krishna. Everything has a relationship with Krishna, but which we can't use in relationship to Krishna. In our service to Krishna, we give it up. Otherwise, things we keep, because the devotee's renunciation is called yukta vairagya, balanced attachment. He gives up those things which cannot be used in the service of Krishna. And the specific reason is because if you give up everything, you may have to close your heart, and then it won't be functional to open it for Krishna. Therefore, there's verses that say that one who is eligible for bhakti is one who is not too attached or too detached. If one is just a gross materialist, he won't be interested in changing his consciousness to serve God. And if one is completely detached from the world, then by his nature as samskaras, he'll see the engagement in devotional service as undesirable. So a devotee has a very, very balanced view of detachment. He gives up those things, hari sambandha, that vastu, which could not which he cannot move in relationship to Hari. And by that process and that purification, then one could become detached from everything, even if he's not focused on becoming detached. Because a devotee becomes detached when he has such a strong spiritual objective. And then one has, but that has to be developed in a very, very practical way. A very, very practical way. And that's called Yukta Vairagya. Is that okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Definitely. Thank you, Bianca. Anybody else like to ask a question? Okay. I have to say, it has picked up on Wednesday. Wednesday is generally a little slow, but we've been getting a good crowd. Now, I was telling you that lecture I was giving, but when I gave the lecture on Sunday in Yogamaya, which is it's a really a great place, I really like to thank them and thank Bryn and the owners there for giving me that facility. It's so wonderful, you know, they're actually having me give a 15-hour bhakti seminar one weekend. I'm trying to figure out, you know, because people are not necessarily devotees, what I'm going to do. I may do the Narada Bhakti Sutras. And I thought maybe on Wednesday I may start doing a verse of the Narada Bhakti Sutras every Wednesday also. We'll see. Anyway, when I gave the class, it was the first time I gave a class. And the first time you give a class, not as organized as the second time you give. It's just the way it works. So I changed the name of the class to The Heart of a Yogi, Exploring the Power of Humility. And I'm not going to give the whole class, but just a few points more that came out in this is... I gave a quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, that the great thing in this world is not so much where we stand, but what direction we're moving. I asked the people to think where you're standing, where you're moving, and I discussed why an intelligent person has to have a spiritual goal. And the goal is not just to have a spiritual goal, or is to attain something that's eternal. It means to reside and live in the reality of spirit, reality of the soul, which is not miserable, temporary, and impure. And that's what ignorance is. Ignorance is when the pure, the eternal, and the happy, it thinks it's the impure, the temporary, and the unhappy, when the soul thinks it's the body. So spiritual reality means to focus it and understand that. And I describe that connection between the body and the soul, that connection between the body and the soul, is self-centeredness. Is self-centeredness. And therefore, humility is foundational in spiritual life. And without that humility, then you appropriate everything. You appropriate everything for your own ego. You bolster the thing that binds you in the illusion that causes you suffering. And therefore, I gave a verse. There's a very wonderful verse where I think it's Prahlad Maharaj, a great saint, says that if one is not a devotee, and devotee means humble, he said, if one is a devotee, he's humble. Even if he's born in a family of dog eaters, he can deliver the world. But one who is not humble, not a devotee, even if he has all 12 brahminical qualities, he cannot even deliver himself. Why? Because even his good qualities of cleanliness and self-control, all his good qualities are appropriated for oneself. Your cleanliness makes you proud. Your austerities make you proud. Your knowledge makes you proud. So, humility is essential. What to speak of bhakti? Because devotion cannot flow from pride. Because pride prevents one from experiencing the appreciation and kindness that creates a devotional heart. It's like a child. When the child is spoiled, no matter what the child gets, the child cannot develop a devotion and loving heart for his parents. So if one is proud, they cannot develop bhakti. So bhakti means humility. And therefore, St. Augustine said the three most important practices to realize the self are humility, humility, humility. So it was interesting in my class. I gave a lot of examples, a lot of stories of saints who are humble. I described last week how one of the real symptoms or qualities of humility is you see that you're in the world of the divine, and therefore you see the world for others and God. Well, a materialistic person sees it as my world for me exclusively, and therefore sees that the world, sees the world in relationship to one's desire. Well, a saintly person sees the world in terms of the desire of God, which is a universal interest, which is also for the benefit of others. So anyway, it was really nice, and I told stories and things like that. I think I gave it a little bit, but I'm trying to give the points that I didn't give. I described why that kind of philosophy, that kind of spirituality, which entails that you're willing to live in another's world, doesn't mean codependence. Living in another person's world means you live in the world of someone who has a pure desire, because his desire is the desire of God. It's the universal interest. And if the person is not pure, it doesn't mean that humility means to live in his selfish desire. It means that you live in the world of that person's needs. What is I wasn't a big rock fan. Somehow that kind of was a funny thing, but I do remember Mick Jagger saying, "You can't always get what you want, but if you try, sometimes you may just get what you need." So you enter, and that's why one enters into the world of a guru. If the guru is living in the world of God, then by following the guru, you live in the world of God. But if the person is looking at, rather than looking at God, he's looking at his followers in terms of objects of his enjoyment, And to enter into that person's world will be to enter into the world of materialism and hell. So I try to make that distinction because people say, okay, now I can become humble, I'll just be abused by others. And then, of course, describing low self-esteem is also not humility, because low self-esteem means that it's a psychological aberration, because you're not great and you want to. You're not great and you want to. So your consciousness is still ego-filled. You're just not feeling you've achieved that. But humility is you're happy about not being great and you don't want to. You're not great and you don't want to. You think yourself less and you're happy about that. Low esteem means you think yourself less and you're miserable about that. So different points I also, covered in that way. Because when you speak about something, but it really had effect on people, because you really make them think. How are you looking at the world? Are you really looking at it in terms of your own desires? Or are you looking at it in terms of the desires of God, the desires of the divine, and the needs of others to be part of that divine? It's such a shift in consciousness, And my pet peeve is when people are not considerate. So important for people to be considerate, think of others' needs and to serve them. But not just but really looking at them as the ideal self, looking at them as the spiritual self, and serving their needs to be part of the world of the divine and for the divine. Okay. Anybody else like to ask any questions or say hello?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, this is Bajrade Devdasi.
You know how much I appreciate that you just never miss the classes, and I have to say that those flatbreads you made for me, they're perfect. The last batch was perfect.
Thank you.
And it's really good. So you can make some more, and I don't know when I'm coming down there. Although Kishori Radha may come up on Saturday, although she asked me I'm going to be here. I'm only going to be here Saturday. And so you could tell her if she's going up, you can send some more up with her. Okay. Anybody else like to say
sure.
Hello? Anybody else?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Gail. Thank you, Gail.
Yeah, I just wanted to see if I heard you properly, that the reason why you said a person who is humble wouldn't, if he's humble in the proper way, he wouldn't be, abused like a doormat, is because the person he is serving is the person who only has, the world's welfare at heart. He's being humble. He's serving the right person,
What I'm saying is he serves the person who himself he's not living in his own world. That person is living in God's world and sees the world for God and others. Therefore, by serving that person, you're entering the world of the divine and serving the universal interest which that person represents. And that's what a teacher is. You know, he doesn't look. Prabhupada never looked at himself as guru. He doesn't even look at himself as Vaishnava. Bhakti Siddhanta said if one thinks he's a Vaishnava, he's not a Vaishnava. He doesn't have that egotistical conception. Mm-hmm. And therefore, to serve that person, you know, is serving, you know, is not for that person, it's for God, it's for the divine, it's for others. So you enter into that world. And the contrast is someone who has an egotistical conception. And I like the books of Srila Bhakti Rakshaka Sridhar Maharaj. And he said something really brilliant about that's not humility, you know. But it doesn't mean you can't serve someone who doesn't have that vision. But what it means is to serve his desires when his desires are in need.
Wait, say that again?
It means you may serve a person who may not be at that platform. We serve everyone. But when a person is not pure, you serve their desires when their desires represent their needs. Mm-hmm. And you serve their needs even if it doesn't represent their desires. The
right.
focus is on the person's needs.
Yeah.
You know, therefore, you know, parents serving a child doesn't become the servant of the child in the way that he puts the child in the center of the universe and creates an egotistical conception in the child. But he still serves the child because the child has needs. Mm-hmm. And a spiritual parent sees, well, what are those needs? Those needs ultimately are for the child to become liberated. And therefore the child requires affection, the child requires boundaries, the child requires needs. You know? An example of a good parent is your guide, Savitri Bhattacharya. You know, I always liked when I was over there how she trained those kids, her two sons, you know. And even though they come from a high-class Brahmin family, you know, she understood what the child's needs were, you know, in the world. And therefore, you know, they had musical talent and you know, they played, you know, they learned other, you know, trumpet or whatever they learned too, you know, because she saw very practically what their needs were in the world to be functional. But her goal was always that they become pure devotees of Krishna. And they became pretty good devotees, those kids, you know, pretty nice devotees. Okay, Gail is helping you here. Understanding what I was saying.
It was nice to hear for the, you know, I feel like for the first time, a good reasoning for how a humble person can avoid being like a doormat, you know.
Yeah, otherwise it becomes so confusing, you know. The person would still be, you know, very submissive, you know, humble, you know, but the limit will be there. And that's codependence. The limit is this does not serve the ideal self. Right? This mm-hmm. just fortifies that person's ego. But it doesn't go to the other side that one, you know, if it's, you know, likes to serve people, you know. But, you know, when it comes to that extent, then the line is drawn.
Yeah, you're looking for people's welfare, not necessarily their whims.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Thank you, Gail.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay. It's a different crowd than Sunday, generally, except for Gail and Gerard and Overdot. You know, it's like it's a little bit different. You know. And so anyway, I'm pretty happy with this format that I just get to share what I'm doing and preaching and studying and teaching. It seems to be effective pretty soon. If I don't ever have anything that I'm specifically teaching, then the things that I'm preparing, because it seems that, you know, one thing that Borijan, who's kind of like a mentor to me, a friend and a mentor, is one really tries to figure out what his service is. You know, and I'm just saying is my service is to give seminars and speak. It's one of the main things. So I'm really focused on that, and I'm getting so many opportunities to do that. We have the Bhagavad Gita class up here. It's a small group, but I'm going to be teaching Friday. And then Sunday I'll go and to Hartford, a teacher training in the morning. I'll speak on the yoga of forgiveness for 3 hours. Go to Hartford Temple in the afternoon. And then Radhanath Swami will come up the following week to speak. And then on the 26th, I'll go to Jivan Mukta. Yogeshwar has invited me. I'll also speak about forgiveness there, but in a different way. And then on the 30th, I'll be at Vrajarade's for a program, which will be really nice in New Jersey. Gail, you're certainly welcome. All my disciples, students, friends, whatever, welcome. And then on the 12th, which will be a Thursday, I'm going to do something at Yoga Maya. I'm going to do something called the Bhakti Story. And I'm going to try to get someone to do kirtan with it. On the 22nd, I have 6-hour Bhakti teacher training. So a lot of opportunities. And in September, 15 hours of Bhakti course to new people. So a lot of opportunities for sharing and my service. Okay, I'm rambling on now. It's really great being with this Wednesday group. I can feel the enthusiasm, and it's drawing me out to say something. Thank you all very much. Thank you.